Well, each book came out of the reaction to the previous one, I think, partly because I learned so much from talking to people about the ideas in the book, but also I think because what I tried to do, and what feminists always try to do, is to find words to describe an experience that many women are experiencing something, but we can't describe it to each other. And we think maybe there's something wrong with us or we're the only ones. And we're troubled by that. And as soon as you can find the language and the opportunity and the permission to talk about things, everything opens up and everybody feels better, even if it's something that's hard or unhappy. Just the knowledge that you're not alone. Mm-hmm. And one of the other benefits of writing these books is that I figured out my own life, which has been very useful. So this one in particular, writing about love at midlife in your 60s, 50s, 70s, was very helpful to me.
In the past, you've sort of kind of led us into what it's like to be aging and to deal with life, especially since everyone lives longer now and doesn't really go right into old age. But this is different. This is talking about other people. It's talking about a new intimacy. It's different in that you're concentrating on relationships rather than coping.
Which is not to say that coping isn't a big component of relationships. I hadn't thought about that, but it's probably true. What the overarching theme, though, is this new stage of life, and that it is a big deal. It's not just menopausal madness, that in our 50s, 60s, whenever it happens, we really make a transition into a new way of feeling and responding to the world that is comparable to adolescence. And it's certainly related to the fact that the life expectancy is longer. And it's especially related to an observation that Laura Carstensen, a wonderful sociologist in Stanford, has made, which is that we tend to think of these added-on years, this 25-year gift, as coming at the end. So it's sort of tacked on after you're 70, you get this 25 years to be old. In fact, it's inserted in the middle. It's a whole new piece of life that is there to figure out right after your 40s. And it is not a getting older period. It's a sort of reinvention period. And I found that insight very helpful in terms of what I found when I was interviewing people for the book, which is that their relationships are in turmoil. Mm-hmm. That as we approach this new stage of life, we begin to question a lot of stuff, just the way teenagers do. You know, who am I? What am I going to do with the rest of my life? What's going on with my body? Who loves me? Who do I love? All of these same questions come up at this stage. And I think this becomes a period of reevaluation of everything, so that I write about work, I write about friendships, I write about one's relationship to oneself, about relationship to our parents, daughters and mothers in particular. I think it's extremely challenging for daughters who have grown up through the women's movement to make peace with the life experience of their mothers. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I mean, you could say this is more about relationships.
Mm. Would you go into more about making peace with their mothers? I can imagine what you mean and why it would be difficult, but talk about what that process is.
Well, I can talk mainly about my experience. When I began to discover or feel empowered and able in my 20s and 30s to imagine taking on the world in some way and having some impact on the world, I, you know, had lost respect for the housewife, mother, not obedient. My mother was never obedient, but she was the homemaker. And she was a wonderful artist. She was a great artist. And actually what happened with her is that she was liberated by widowhood. As soon as my father died, her life took off. She got her PhD at 82. So even she rejected that life. But I think that at this stage, as we look at our mothers, I feel much more understanding and compassion for the choices she made. And instead of feeling that sort of disrespecting the fact that she didn't fight for more independence, I share what I believe was her disappointment. And it makes it easier. I mean, I think a lot of the relationship issues involve making peace. In a long-term marriage, you make peace with each other's faults. In terms of yourself, you make peace with who you are and you accept things. You accept who you are. I feel that in terms of difficult relationships with parents or siblings, that same kind of empathy is available in some situations. Yeah. I mean, there are some people, I talk about a woman in the book whose parents were just so awful that her midlife liberation was not making peace with them, but with walking away from them. And the minute that she made peace with the fact she'd never make peace with them, she blossomed. But that kind of resolution is very, very important, I think.
Did you find that most people who are going through this deal with it by changing and getting rid of the relationships that they had before and getting new relationships, or do most of them make arrangements?
Both. I think a lot of the thinking is about which relationships are worth sustaining and which have become either toxic or irrelevant. It's very tricky. For example, people who have stopped working in an office have to reevaluate those relationships with their coworkers, which, when you're working in an office, become very intimate but may not sustain that kind of intimacy outside. Same with parents. A lot of people made really important relationships with the parents of their children. But as parenting becomes less of your obsession, that kind of relationship also can not have what you need. But mainly there are just, we've accumulated so many relationships in our lives. And when you look at them one by one, you can tell which are the ones that are supportive and which are the ones that are holding you back or just don't have a heart anymore. And the ones that are supportive aren't necessarily perfect. It's that you see the glass half full and you say, this is a relationship that has value or meaning. Sometimes it's only because it's historic, somebody you've known forever. But other times it's like a long-term marriage. You say, that's who he is. And I'm just going to focus. The glass is half full of his good stuff and half empty of his bad stuff. And that's the way it is. And half full is pretty good. Then there's a whole bunch of people that I interviewed, many more than I expected, who are really starting over. Starting over specifically in the romance department. Most of the women I talk to are so invested for life with their friends, for example, that they're never going to trade in their circle of trust. But there are a lot of women who have waited for this moment to get the nerve, get the confidence, be able to set aside some responsibilities and get out of a bad situation. And that takes so much courage. But once you've found that courage, you're really raring to go when you get out. And I cannot tell you how many great love stories I heard, really beautiful love stories. How many stories of women who discovered that they didn't want the intensity of a one-on-one relationship, that they were at a point in their lives where they wanted to be their own boss, and that they found ways to find or not find sex, find or not find people to travel with, but that basically they weren't looking for love with a capital L. And there was another group of women who, when they got out of a heterosexual relationship and started looking around at the world and their lives and the people they cared about, found themselves falling in love with women.
Really?
It's in many cases, women who were their best friends. And that's a whole other development. Pepper Schwartz, who's a wonderful sexologist, points out that you get to this point and you say, okay, my standard for intimacy, for true, reliable intimacy, people who are going to be there for you, the standard is my women friends. Mm. And if you are in an experimental mode, if you have always had some attraction to women, why not now? Hmm. Why not try it out? So what I found is that once we get to the point, and again, this transition is longer than we would like. I call it the fertile void because it really is a stretch of time where you don't know what's happening. And it's frightening and disconcerting. But you'll also surprise yourself and learn about yourself. And once you get your feet on the ground, there's a lot more courage, a lot more willingness to try new things that is going to play out in your relationships as well as, you know, mountain climbing and everything else.
Do you think that this is happening? This can't be happening simply because we're living longer and we're healthier. There's got to be more than that. Why people are doing this at this point.
I think there's no question that had it not been for the women's movement, this would not be happening to women. There is absolutely no question in my mind. We would just spend more time getting older. But as I was saying about our mothers, we really broke with the past. Many of us felt we overbroke with the past and gave away life experiences without considering whether we might need them or want them. I mean, a lot of people, you know, have regrets. But basically, there was this sense of breaking free. And I feel that even women who did not participate, even women who sneered at the women's movement, they saw it. They saw women reading the news, women astronauts, women athletes, women politicians. The definition of being an adult woman was expanded. And even if they didn't change their lives then, those are some of the women who are most anxious to change their lives now, to find a career, to travel, to be on their own. All kinds of experiences that they knew were out there but couldn't get to earlier in their lives are now available. I mean, in this economy, they're less available than we wish they were. But so what happens, it's interesting among those women, or I think most women feel that this is a time when they can try new things. Men, on the other hand, as they wind down their careers, want to either, I'm generalizing now, but many men want to either take it easy or travel willy-nilly without having any commitments. And this can cause stress between such a man and his wife, who is finally saying, it's my time. And one of the things that has to be negotiated in a long-standing marriage is the different expectations of the next 20 years. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't necessarily mean, if you have different expectations, that you have to go your separate ways. But it's often surprising to either partner what the other's expectations are. They aren't what you thought.
What are some of the most surprising stories that you found? What surprised you the most from, we should say that you have been interviewing people for the book and you have encouraged them to get in touch with you so that you could base this on experiences that other people would have. What are some of the surprising things?
Well, you have to understand that I, feminist or not, am a little bit of a prude. So that the story after story of really transporting sex and experiments and internet conversations, you know, really very sexy internet conversations, and finding wonderful relationships with younger men because they are so willing to explore new kinds of sexuality. I think I had bought into the notion that sex was not a big prospect at this stage of life. Mm-hmm. And so the big surprise to me was, first of all, how many women were not going to buy into that. And second of all, how many women are really having a very, very good time, despite so much that goes against it, which is, first of all, the assumption that it's unseemly to be interested in sex. But I was surprised that given the fact that we are led to be so ashamed of our bodies, mm-hmm. the idea of a new relationship in that kind of, you know, saggy, wrinkled body, my expectation was that would hold people back. Mm-hmm. But not so. Because they have become so clear about what they want and who they are, there's a sort of take me as I am attitude, which is not to say that they don't work out and diet and all of that when they put themselves out there, but there's just so much you can do. Yeah. But the enjoyment of sex, all kinds of sex, meaningful long-term sex, one-night stands, internet sex, masturbation, whatever outlet is available, women are really finding their way to it and enjoying it. And women who I think if you'd asked them 10 years ago would have said, no way.
Okay. Yeah. You have a chapter called about something in the dark, loving in the dark or something like that. Is that what that is?
Dressing in the dark.
Oh, okay.
That chapter is based on a scene in the Meryl Streep movie. Anyway, in this scene, in this movie, she is, in the movie, she has gotten re-involved with her ex-husband. Not romantically, she thinks, but just because they have things to do with each other. And finally, they realize that they are more romantic, and they spend the night together. And the next morning, the sunlight is pouring in, and he gets out of the rumpled bed, totally naked, and waddles off in all his flabby glory into the bathroom. And she gets up from under the sheets and wraps the sheets around her and turns her back and starts to dress. And he looks into the room and he said, "Why are you doing that? We were naked last night." And she said, "Ah, but we were lying down." And so, as I was saying before, even though we have a certain aesthetic concern for how our bodies look, that doesn't hold us back. And even though we'll dress in the dark, we're still there for the night before.
Let's talk about the research you did for this book, because I'm wondering if it's your circle of friends that you're talking to, or if this is widespread, or if this is America, or what are we talking about?
It's definitely, to my knowledge, I've only got information on America. But it is not my friends. I cast as wide a net as I could. I posted a questionnaire on several websites for women and asked quite personal questions and got back really detailed and honest-sounding answers and offers from some of these women to be interviewed further, which I did. So it is self-selected in the sense that I was talking about a life experience that if somebody didn't have, they wouldn't have responded to the questionnaire. But as far as I can tell, the range is as wide as I could have gotten it. Obviously, the economic factors are always important, and nobody has the luxury of self-discovery if you can't put food on the table. So it's limited in that respect. But I think that one reason women haven't wanted to talk about the positive side of their romantic and sexual lives is that they're a little embarrassed, first of all, because who would have thought? But also, I think they don't want to jinx it. And, you know, it's more common to complain. There are no men, there are no whatever. So it's hard to bring it up, you know, that I'm having a good time. When do you bring that up? After all your friends have said they're having a bad time? Mm-hmm. So I feel confident that I am talking about a widespread condition.
So do you think people say things, or the women who answered, say things to you that they are not saying to their friends?
Yes, I definitely do. But this is the marvel of the Internet. And I talk a little about the kind of intimacy that's fostered on the Internet, because you can be your darkest self online. You can be your wildest self. You can be a whole other person. And you can, nobody will know. And if you look at some of these websites, not only for women, older women, but like for mothers. You know, there are a lot of websites for bad mothers, for people who feel they're not measuring up. And they tell the truth, which we've all known, that it's hard and it's annoying and you get impatient and you make mistakes. But the Internet is sort of a free space to tell the truth, because no chips fall where they may. Mm-hmm. You can go back to feeling guilty when you're done. So I do think that I got truer answers for this book, which I did more on the Internet, than probably the other books. The other books, I had to find people and spend hours with them. Mm-hmm. So that had to be fewer interviews. Mm-hmm. And this book, therefore, doesn't have as many long stories. It has snippets. The structure is different. Mm-hmm.
Tell me some of the questions that you asked.
Let me back up a bit, because my purpose in writing this book, although we've talked only about sex and romance, was to expand the definition of love at midlife and find out whether I was right in thinking that women of my age have many more sources of love and satisfaction and fulfillment than maybe even they would list. I have a whole chapter on work. I do believe it's possible to love your work. And that can give you sustenance. Especially at this stage, many people try to find work that is socially valuable. Your work can be very meaningful to you. Your own company can become some love component in your life.
Your own company, you mean to be in your own company or your own company that you own?
Oh, to be in your own company. I quote from the Elizabeth Cady Stanton essay, Solitude of Self, where she talks about how the whole process of being with yourself. And Marianne Moore, the poet, wrote something that I think about all the time. She says, the only cure for loneliness is solitude. People can find the kind of emotional feedback that they need and want, once they know what they need and want, in a wider range of places and experiences than fit the usual definition. Grandchildren is a perfect example. I don't have grandchildren, so this is a miracle to me, how absolutely dotty people get about their grandchildren, and how men, for a lot of men, it's a second chance. And they become, you know, they weren't the fathers they wanted to be. So this is all a wonder to them because they've missed a lot of childhood. I do think that grandchildren are a gigantic source of emotional support. Friends, everybody I talk to, and I have to say that I have hardly met anybody who got through to a positive place without calling on or noticing that her friends were key players. I now cherish my friends more than ever. Mm-hmm. I was busy before I knew who they were, and I loved them, but the priorities changed. They were on the priority list, but they weren't high up. And a lot of us are finding that now that we have a little time and room, our friends fill up that time and room. Lots of women travel with their friends. Book clubs are, I think, a great source of consciousness raising. So I think it can't be discounted that if you have a group of true friends, that you have in your life a source of love and an object of love. And it's a shame to discount it. In the last chapter, I talk about a friend, which is funny because she just wrote me, she'd read the book and she didn't recognize herself. She had a fabulous career. She was a breakthrough professional. She is now teaching young people that profession. She's been a widow for about 30 years. She has a son and daughter-in-law that she's very close to. She has grandchildren she adores. She travels with friends. She goes to the theater with friends. She's taken up painting and found out she's very good at it. And I have, over the years, sat across from her in the diner and said, gee, your life sounds pretty good. And she says, what do you mean? Why can't you find me a man? And I think about her because she is not counting the kinds of love that she's getting and giving. She's a sort of walking definition of what I'm trying to talk about. I mean, in terms of all the things that are at play in her life. Mm-hmm.
that sort of brings me to the question I had in mind earlier. Are you finding people who aren't making the transition, who aren't making the change, or who are just kind of crumbling and falling apart with whatever demands are brought about by this stage of life?
Well, those are the people, I think, who would not have responded to my questionnaire.
Oh, okay.
I try to make very clear that this is a selective group and that they are people who are curious or a little experienced or have heard and think it sounds cool about the possibilities of this stage of life. I think if I had asked them, which I didn't, do you have a friend who's given up? They would all say yes. And several of them said to me that often when they thought about shedding friends, those were the ones who said, why are you doing that? And, you're trying to act like your daughter, or fearful and negative things. It's harder and harder to be around those people. They always say, I didn't completely put her out of my life, but I don't see her as much as I used to.
Okay. Did you find any useful or creative ways of coping with, and here I'm getting back to coping again, of coping with going into older age? Or, you know, we were talking earlier before we started the interview about living in place and other movements like that. Did you find some exciting developments there?
Well, practical developments, I think, are very, will make a big difference as we age. There's no question that isolation is the absolute killer as you age. And one of the great things about the internet is that it's made it possible for people not to be so isolated. Mm-hmm. But human interaction is the single most important element to have in your life. Therefore, I think a lot of us feel that we've got so much we want to do and so many people we want to interact with. And we want to stay in our homes. We want to, as they say, age in place. And I think a lot of the considerations that we make are where we're going to live so that we can do that and how we're going to live so we can do that. We used to have a joke that we would found an old feminist's home and we'd all line our rockers up on the porch and fade away. But the truth is that wouldn't work because somebody's going to get sick. Somebody's going to get dementia. Somebody's going to run out of money. Somebody is going to get married or find a partner. And that you can't be sentimental about the format that you choose. You have to really make practical choices. And one of the things that I talk about is the notion of care getting. Because we are often called upon, and this is a big burden of this stage of life, to care for aging parents and returning kids. But it's really important, I think this is my only piece of advice, to turn it around. As Gloria says, Gloria Steinem always says, that it's time for a new golden rule, which is to do unto yourself as you've been doing unto others. And that's not only emotional. When you're taking care of an aging parent, you're trying to figure out what services are available, how to prepare financially. My mother was able to die in her own house. I feel very good about that. And I want the same. But it's not going to happen if we just sit in our house and die. There's a lot of planning needed to be done. And the good news is that there are a lot of communities emerging that are all connected by an organization called iVillage, which I have in my resource guide, which is very informative about the ways in which people are putting together mutually supportive communities that suit the area and the people and their needs. Probably, if I were thinking about that right now, I would look at those communities and consider moving from one place to live among people who have set up that kind of community. Because the idea is that the kinds of things that you will need as you age can be supplied by people your age who live nearby. I think that we're going to want that more. And the good news is I think that there are more options going to be available, which is not to say that until we develop a better social contract in this country, if on no other issue than caregiving, it's never going to work the way it should.
What's never going to work?
Democracy. society. The whole idea of society is that people take care of each other. And that the whole idea of a government is that it takes care of the people. And that we are so far behind other countries in terms of giving support to people raising children, giving support to people who are caring for elderly parents. I ran across so many people who gave up their lives, gave up their careers, whose marriages came apart under the stress of taking care of an aging parent because there was no service available. And this is not the greatest society on earth. It could be.
I'm talking to Suzanne Levine, and we've talked many times before, but this time we're talking about her new book, How We Love Now, Sex and the New Intimacy in Second Adulthood. From things that you were just saying, it almost seems as though you're just finding things to explore, things to want to change. What's the outcome of your having done this research and written this book? What are you feeling that you need to do and that needs to be done now?
I think that the big challenge for us is to combat ageism in the way that we combated sexism when we were younger. By our example and by our efforts, political efforts, community efforts, we can change the image of somebody in their 60s and 70s and not change it in a way that 60 is the new 40, but that there are great things about 60. And I have to tell you that in all the books I've written about being 50 or 60 or 70, I have never met anyone who wanted to go back to being 20 or 30. Again, it's a self-selected group, but I'm telling you there are droves and droves of women who would never want to trade these years in. And that message has to get out there.
Well, thank you once again. And I want to invite listeners to look back. We can put up podcasts on the website of former interviews that we've done with Suzanne Levine. Thanks for spending the time.
Thank you.